Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's editor. Our selections for this series have included many different voices and styles. A particularly rich and distinctive voice in our genre belongs to Edgar, Anthony, Agatha, and McCavity Award winner Margaret Maron. A North Carolinian, Margaret began her career with short stories, and she backed into writing novels, as she puts it. Her first mystery series was set in New York and featured Police Lieutenant Sigrid Harold, but love of her native state soon led her to create the Deborah Knott series of novels set in small-town North Carolina. Publishers Weekly has called Margaret Maron one of the most seamless Southern writers since Margaret Mitchell, and her novel Bootlegger's Daughter made the Independent Mystery Booksellers Association's list of 100 favorite mysteries of the century. Here she is reading her Edgar, Anthony, and Agatha-nominated story, Virgo and Sapphires, from the December 2001 EQMM. After the reading, please join Margaret and me and authors Nancy Picard and Carolyn Hart for an interview conducted at the Malice Domestic Convention earlier this year. This is the same interview that appears after episode 12 in our podcast series featuring Carolyn Hart.
Virgo and Sapphires by Margaret Maron. When Laura Hart opened the door that Saturday morning in early September, she found the postman busily stuffing their mailbox, car keys in one hand, an expensive flat leather purse in the other. She gave a quick glance at her small gold wristwatch and saw that she had plenty of time to chat a moment before meeting her friend Sylvia for lunch. Laura believed in kindness and courtesy. "Looks like someone's having a birthday," the postman said, handing over a thick sheaf of mail. A bright pink envelope decorated with summer flowers slipped to the ground, and he quickly retrieved it. "Me," Laura smiled, "tomorrow." 30, one of life's major milestones, a time to take stock of the past and take charge of the future. All week, cards had been arriving from far-flung friends and relatives. Her sister had sent one bordered in black, mock sympathy for growing so old. And her parents and in-laws had sent sweetly sentimental congratulations. Most of the other cards were funny variations on the aging theme. She thanked the postman for his good wishes that she have a happy birthday, inquired about the arthritis in his knee, and listened to his answer with what appeared to be genuine interest. Then when he moved on to the next house, she laid the bills and junk mail on the hall table and tucked the rest in her purse beside several other cards she had planned to share with Sylvia over lunch. Her friend could use a good laugh, thought Laura, as she drove the short distance from her home in an old historic district of Raleigh to their favorite restaurant just off Glenwood Avenue. Although Sylvia swore that nothing was wrong, she'd seemed so edgy lately that Laura wondered if she was starting to realize that divorcing Simon might have been a mistake. All last year it had been, "Virgo should never marry Sagittarians. Sagittarians are grasshoppers, feckless, irresponsible. Sagittarians promise you diamonds, then give you rhinestones." And throughout the legal procedures, she'd been as giddy as a girl in love at the thought of regaining her freedom, of putting order back into her life, of being accountable to no one. These last few weeks, however, she had begun to speak wistfully of the little things she missed now that there was no husband of her own around anymore, Sagittarian or no Sagittarian. Like Laura, Sylvia was a Virgo too, with a 27th birthday of her own just 5 days later. Unlike Laura, Sylvia took their daily horoscopes very seriously. She and Simon had bickered for ages. But to say that they should have divorced or never even married simply because Simon had been born in December? How silly, thought Laura. "What about Will and me?" she'd teased. "According to you, Gemini and Virgo are just as badly matched, yet look at us. Married 5 years and couldn't be happier." Sylvia had shrugged. "Only because he was born on the cusp of Cancer, Virgo's perfect mate. Simon and I are flat in the middle of our signs." The calendar might read September, but the sun was as hot as July and the air still held August's sticky humidity. Laura was glad to enter the restaurant's air-conditioned coolness. Sylvia was already there, sleek and beautiful in a sleeveless green linen dress, her long blonde hair tied back with a matching silk scarf to set off her pearl earrings. Even though Sylvia was one of her closest friends, Laura couldn't help noting a slight softening in the other woman's upper arms, a hint of sag above the elbow. Complacently, she knew that her own upper arms were as firm as daily workouts could make them, and her plum-colored dress was also sleeveless. Virgos were supposed to be detail-oriented, she thought, with a sudden touch of bitchiness, and wondered when Sylvia would realize she wouldn't be able to go bare-armed much longer. I love that color, Sylvia sighed as Laura joined her at the table, but purple makes me look so washed out. They say blondes have more fun, Laura said, so it's only fair that brunettes should get to wear purple. The restaurant wasn't too crowded at the moment, and their waiter came right away to take their order. Over glasses of Chardonnay, as the two women waited for their food, Laura used her butter knife to slit open the bright-colored envelopes, and soon they were laughing at some of the more risque birthday cards with their bawdy suggestions for how to celebrate. One card even held a long, sausage-shaped, flesh-colored balloon with such extremely graphic instructions that Laura turned red and hastily hid it in her purse while Sylvia laughed out loud. Eventually, Laura opened a small square card. Her smile turned to puzzlement, and she looked more carefully at the ivory-toned envelope, turning it in her hand to seek a return address. There was only a dark blue Gothic F imprinted on the flap. "What is it?" asked Sylvia. "I'm not sure. I thought it was another birthday card. Now I see it's addressed to Mr. and Mrs. William Hart, but the note itself is to Will. It's..." "Oh, my stars!" she exclaimed as her eyes raced through the short message. "Listen to this, Syl. Dear Mr. Hart, I thoroughly enjoyed meeting you and assisting you with the jewelry selection. The sapphire earrings are perfectly beautiful. I do hope Mrs. Hart is pleased with her birthday present. She's a very lucky woman. Thank you so much for shopping with us, and I look forward to serving you again. Sincerely, Susan Dunzel, Fitchett's Jewelers." Sylvia's blue eyes widened. "Fitchett's? That's the most expensive store in Raleigh." Laura was re-examining the envelope. "The postmark's smudged, but it seems to have been mailed yesterday afternoon. She must have thought it wouldn't arrive till Monday, after my birthday was passed." A happy glow suffused her face, and she shook her head in rueful amusement. "Sapphire earrings? That dear, sneaky man. All month he's been saying that his sales were down and commissions were off. I thought tomorrow was going to be nothing more exciting than breakfast in bed and maybe a dozen roses." Knowing how much Sylvia loved earrings, especially earrings set with precious gemstones, Laura wasn't surprised to glance up and find naked envy in Sylvia's pale blue eyes. Envy and something else. Anger? Sylvia was notorious for her hot temper. She leaned across the table and said, "Listen, Syl, promise me that you'll never tell Will, okay? He must be planning a really special day, and he'd be so disappointed if he ever learns that I knew about it ahead of time." "As if I'd have a chance," Sylvia said sarcastically. "I got custody of you. Simon got custody of Will, remember?" Laura nodded. That was another awkward result of divorce. Spouses couldn't help taking sides. After Simon and Sylvia split, Will said he just didn't feel comfortable spending any time with her. Not that he seemed to spend much time with Simon, either. Their friendship had been quite casual, occasioned more by their wives than by mutual interest. But Laura assumed his distaste for Sylvia was due to male solidarity, and she hadn't questioned his stand. Fortunately, Sylvia usually chose to make a joke of it, liking it to another division of marital property, as if Laura were a set of cookware and Will the microwave oven. All winter, Laura had felt bad about not inviting Sylvia over to the house when Will was there, but her friend had just shrugged. "Simon's probably convinced Will that the divorce was all my idea." It wouldn't have taken much convincing. Sylvia clearly wanted out of the marriage much more than the bewildered Simon had. And Laura had picked up on enough clues to realize that the divorce wasn't merely a conflict of celestial signs. Syl was too radiant, and usually too busy to meet with any of her women friends for lunch, or to make their weekly gym dates after work. Clearly there was a man involved. Moreover, a man she expected to marry or move in with as soon as she dumped Simon. This Virgo's not meant to live alone, she said cryptically. Unfortunately, it did not seem to be happening. The decree was final 2 months ago, yet Syl wouldn't admit she was seeing anyone special. Moreover, her kitten and cream radiance had dimmed in the last couple of weeks. She was brittle and more short-tempered than usual, for all the world like a woman who suspects she's about to be dumped herself. Their food arrived, polenta with portobello mushrooms and smoked mozzarella on a bed of leafy greens. Laura put away her birthday cards and spent the rest of their meal trying to dispel the gray cloud that suddenly hovered over their table. Sylvia's mercurial mood swings were legendary among her friends. She could be sunny, charming, and amusing one minute, stormy and vindictive the next. For some reason, her earlier good humor had now vanished. She drank 3 glasses of wine in rapid succession, snarled at the waiter, and rudely asked the people at the next table what they were staring at. Laura braced herself for the worst, and it came as they were leaving. She heard a crash behind her and turned to see that their hapless waiter had somehow upset a tray of cold potato soup into the laps of those same people. Sylvia herself did not look back. With chin held high, she seemed oblivious to the chaos behind her. Only the satisfied little smile on her lips betrayed her. As they parted outside the restaurant, she again wished Laura a happy birthday, then spoiled it by sending sarcastic regards to the world's most perfect husband. On Monday, Sylvia called Laura at work. She'd spent a lonely weekend racked by jealousy. Lucky Laura was going to be wined and dined and given sapphire earrings and probably bedded by her very sexy husband. What would her own birthday bring? Her horoscope promised something special in the air, but Sylvia couldn't bring herself to believe it. Her lover had promised to come Friday night, but could she believe him any more than her horoscope? They used to spend every free moment together. He couldn't seem to get enough of her. Lately, though, he claimed to be working longer hours. But was he really working? She knew that hearing Laura chirp and burble about Will's extravagant gift would make her even more jealous. Nevertheless, she still called and asked, "So, how was your birthday?" "Awful," Laura moaned. "The worst in my whole life." Apprehensively, Sylvia said, "What's wrong?" "I can't talk about it now. I'll start crying again. Could you meet me at the gym after work?" By the time Sylvia got to the gym and changed into shorts and tank tops she wore while working out, she found a grim-faced Laura pumping furiously at the stationary bike. Her face was already shiny with perspiration, and her dark hair curled in damp ringlets across her forehead. "Whoa," said Sylvia, sliding into the neighboring bank. "Slow down before you have a heart attack. What happened?" "My birthday happened," Laura said tightly. She paused long enough to wipe her face on the towel draped over her bike handles. "Breakfast in bed in the morning, dinner at Antonia's last night." "And?" her friend prompted. "And 35 roses in between, a pink one for every year of my life, plus 5 red ones in the middle for every wonderful year we've been married. Isn't that romantic as hell?" she resumed her furious peddling. Sylvia's blue eyes widened. "No sapphire earrings?" "No sapphire earrings." "But I don't understand," said Sylvia, peddling slowly. "What did he say when you asked him?"
"I didn't."
"But you, my family, all our friends, everyone thinks Will and I have the perfect marriage, and it should be perfect. But you know how Will is." Sylvia shook her head. "He's a salesman," Laura said impatiently. "Charm is part of his stock in trade. That's why he's so good at his job. That's why he can afford to buy sapphires for his new mistress," she added bitterly.
"What?"
"You've seen the way he flirts with my friends at parties. It's almost enough to make me take your nonsense about horoscopes seriously. Gemini, amorous, impulsive, adolescent when it comes to women. That's what you said the first time I told you Will's birth date. Remember? It's so automatic, I don't think he even realizes it himself. Half the women we know would knock me over to get at him if they thought they had a chance. You're the only one he never made a dent in. Look at that note from Fitchett's. You could almost feel the heat coming off the page. I look forward to serving you again. I just bet she does. In her bed, no doubt." "Oh, Laura," Sylvia said sympathetically, "don't torture yourself. Do you really think he's ever been unfaithful?" "I'm not a fool, Sylvia. I can read the signs." But you don't know for sure. No? Laura signaled to the attendant who came over with bottles of chilled water for both of them. She pressed the cold bottle to her hot cheek. Then who did he buy those earrings for? You, of course, said Sylvia, as she uncapped the plastic bottle and took a sip. But maybe he changed his mind, decided he couldn't afford them after all, and took them back. Didn't he tell you his sales were off? I don't know that I can believe him any more. Laura set the water bottle on the floor beside her and began to pedal again. He's been traveling so much this year. I was sure he was seeing someone out of town. It's not all that unusual for men to have a final fling before they settle down for good, is it? The old 7-year itch? Except in his case, it's a 5-year itch. I didn't say anything because I thought if I kept quiet, he'd get over her. And he did. I'm sure he did. These last few weeks have been absolute heaven. He hasn't traveled as much. He's been home early more nights. But now he's starting with someone new. I can feel it, Syl. He's only going through the motions with me yesterday. We didn't even make love. You're probably imagining things, Sylvia said briskly. If he didn't return the earrings, then maybe he's saving them for your anniversary. Our anniversary's not till March. Well, Christmas, then. Laura scowled. The note from Fitchett said birthday. True, Sylvia said slowly. Laura began her cool down and gave a fatalistic sigh. Well, whatever happens, happens. I guess I'll just have to tough it out. Thanks for giving me a shoulder to cry on, Syl. Sylvia wiped her face with the sweatband on her wrist and smiled. That's what friends are for. Want to come over Friday night and celebrate your own birthday? Will has to fly to Chicago for a Saturday morning sales conference. We could invite Liz and Marta, open champagne, have a pajama party. Sylvia shook her head. Sorry, but I've already made plans. In fact, my horoscope says this is going to be an extra special birthday this year. Really? Laura looked at her a long, considering moment. You have that kitten and cream glow on your face again. All I can say is good luck, kid. Hope your birthday turns out better than mine. Sylvia held up 2 crossed fingers. Me too. Sylvia held that thought all through the long week that followed. Waiting for Friday night had been almost like waiting for Christmas morning, but it was finally here. She'd let the housework slide a little since Simon moved out, but this week she had cleaned every night till the house fairly sparkled. 2 places were set at the gleaming dining table. Candlelight bounced off her best china and crystal and was reflected in the silver ice bucket where a bottle of chill champagne waited to toast her birthday. Attention to details, she thought happily, as she laid the carving knife beside the walnut carving board where he would slice a Chateaubriand as soon as it came from the broiler. She wasn't much of a meat eater, but for him, the bloodier the better. Virgos delight in making everything special for the ones they love, Sylvia told herself, and she gave the bedroom a final inspection. Cool, perfumed sheets awaited their hot passion. Already she could feel her body begin to soften, feel herself melting as she thought of where the evening would end. Surely this would be the night that he finally said the words she'd been waiting all these months to hear, that he wanted her as his wife. She was wearing his favorite dress and nothing underneath except a lacy garter belt and stockings. Her long blonde hair fell loosely around her face, just the way he liked her to wear it. She heard his key in her lock and rushed to the door, eager for that first greedy kiss after all these days they'd been apart. She was too excited to analyze whether his embrace was equally passionate, whether his lips met hers as eagerly as in the beginning. She'd been so afraid their affair was cooling, yet here he was, in her arms again, tall and handsome and as desirable as ever. "Happy birthday, honey," Will said, when their lingering kiss had ended and he could finally speak. He handed her a small flat box wrapped in silver paper and tied so tightly with silver ribbons that her eager fingers couldn't undo the bows. "It's so small," she cooed, "so light. What on earth could it be?" "Just a little something I picked up last week to add to your collection." She laughed in delight and kissed him again. Men were so funny, as if her jewelry box were full of real gemstones. These would be her first sapphires. She should have known Will was buying them for her birthday, not Laura's. "Let me get something to cut the ribbons before I break a nail," she said. Will followed her into the dining room and nuzzled the back of her neck while she slipped the knife between the ribbons and tore off the paper. "You smell good," he said huskily as his hand slid inside the front of her dress. "Why don't we skip dinner and go straight to dessert?" "Oh, you silly darling," she said fondly. Yet her body arched in pleasure beneath his hand, and for a moment she almost forgot about his gift. Then the silver paper fell away. Sylvia lifted the box lid and stared blankly. Instead of sapphire earrings, it was a small, ornately engraved silver fork with two flared tines. "What?"
"It's a lemon fork," he said proudly. "The antique dealer said it was probably 1860 to 1870. I know you've showed me your collection a dozen times, but I couldn't remember. You don't already have one, do you?"
"Collection," she thought dully. "My collection of whimsical Victorian silver serving pieces."
"It's as cute as you are," Will said as his fingers cupped her breast.
She heard Laura's voice in her head. "But now he's starting with someone new. I can feel it." Angrily, she slapped his hand away and whirled on him. "You give me a lemon fork? And who gets the earrings, Will?"
"Earrings?
Sapphire earrings from Fitchett's. I know all about them."
"Then you know more than I do," he said with matching anger.
She was in a rage now, remembering her week of loneliness, the nights when he'd told her he was away on business, treating her as if she were Laura, someone he could take for granted, could lie to, could cheat on. Well, she wasn't meek little if I don't ask questions, he'll come back to me, Laura. "What was tonight?" she screamed, her fury fueled by humiliation at how he planned to use her. "One last time before you move on to greener pastures? Who else are you sleeping with?"
"You're crazy," he blustered.
But his guilt was so glaringly obvious that even he recognized it. "Oh, the hell with this," he snarled. "I've had it with your temper tantrums and your jealousy. Who needs it?" He had taken only one step away from her when he felt a stunning blow on his back, then such pain as he had never known. Something held him, clawing at his lungs. He pulled away, glanced back, and saw the gory knife in her hands, his own life's blood dripping from its deadly point. It was the last thing he ever saw. The police officers were gentle. They hated having to come and tell the widows, but this one seemed to have her emotions in check now that the initial shock was wearing off. "Poor Will," she said sadly. Sylvia wasn't his first affair, and she wouldn't have been his last, but she was the one with the hottest temper. All the others seemed to have gone quietly. "She keeps screaming about a pair of sapphire earrings, Mrs. Hart, that he'd bought them for someone else, not her."
"Earrings?" asked Laura, looking up at the officers as if bewildered.
"Yes, ma'am. Said you thought they were for his new mistress, and this time you were right."
Laura shook her head. "I'm sorry. I honestly don't know what she's talking about." She answered the officer's other questions with stoic bravery, but when they were gone, she went into the bedroom and found the card still stuck in her purse with her birthday cards. She smiled as she looked at it a final time. Wonderful what you could do with computers and a good printer these days. As if Fitchett's would ever hire the sort of salesperson who would write such a gushy, indiscreet note. The slightly smudged postmark that she'd created for the envelope had been a lovely touch, and she was sorry Sylvia hadn't bothered to look at it. So much for Virgo's vaunted attention to detail, she thought scornfully. All that zodiac nonsense, and where'd it gotten Sylvia? Sitting in jail and facing trial for murder. She, on the other hand, was now a widow, well rid of a cheating spouse and a traitorous friend. In fact, she was now a very well-to-do widow indeed, Laura thought, suddenly remembering the hefty insurance policy on Will's life, his company's generous retirement plan, the stocks and CDs they'd acquired together. All hers now. She had hoped Sylvia would make a scene in a restaurant when he didn't produce that non-existent pair of sapphire earrings for her birthday. She had thought that maybe Sylvia would publicly embarrass Will, perhaps even smash him over the head with a wine bottle and put him in the hospital with a concussion. She had only meant to punish the two of them a little before suing Will for divorce.
It truly had not occurred to her that things could turn out this well. She shredded the counterfeit Fitchett's card and flushed away the pieces. Fitchett's. Such an excellent store. Once the estate was settled, maybe she'd pay them a visit. Buy something tasteful for herself. In emeralds, perhaps. Or rubies. She'd never really cared much for sapphires.
Virgo and Sapphires is copyrighted by Margaret Maron. It was recorded at the Malice Domestic Convention, as was the following interview. Good evening.
I'm very lucky tonight to be at the Boucher... at the Malice Domestic Convention in Washington, D.C., where I'm joined by three absolutely wonderful authors. Carolyn Hart, who has written many series, among them Henry O., who has appeared in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine at short story length and also appears at novel length, of course. And Margaret Maron, who has written stories in her Sigrid Herald series for EQMM and also writes those stories at novel length. And Nancy Picard, who has written Marie Lightfoot stories for us and also does that series at novel length. And Jenny Kane, of course, that she's well known for. Too many credits for all of these great writers to go into now. But what interests me to start off with is that they write short stories and novels, and so I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the difference between writing a short story and a novel and how you feel about each form. And why don't we start with Margaret, who began her career with short stories.
Absolutely, start with me. I spent my first 12 years of my professional life, and I have not had a drink. Yes. I spent the first 12 years of my professional life writing short stories, and short stories was what I first sold, and this was where I had given my heart, and I thought this was all that I would ever do. And then the short story market sort of dried up, and I backed into writing novels. But I still do like the short story, and to me the difference, which is not what you ask, but the difference between the short story and the novel is when I was writing short stories, I would get an idea for a plot, and then I would think of characters who could do the plot so that it all seemed rather natural. When I came to write novels, I might have had started with an idea of a plot, but these characters would not jump through those hoops that I had prepared.
Isn't that interesting?
So I find that while short stories to me are more about plot, the novels are more about character. What do you think, Nancy?
I think that it's true. Although I do really enjoy exploring character in short stories, I think because, although you can't get into them in depth, as I think you're implying, mm-hmm. I enjoy it because I will tackle characters in a short story that I would never tackle in a novel, mm-hmm. partly because they may be people I don't want to spend a novel's worth of time with. I recently had a short story published that was about a woman who killed her children. Well, I don't want to spend a novel's worth of time, months and months and months, with that mm-hmm. character, but I was happy to put her in a very short, short story. And there are other situations like that, too, in which I'll think of a character that either it's somebody who's unpleasant enough that I don't want to spend that much of my time with, or somebody who about whom I can't really devise a long story, but I'd love to write something short about them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you did start with short stories, didn't you? In fact, didn't you debut in our Department of First Stories?
I did. Bless Ellery Queen's heart. Yeah, mm-hmm. I departed. Let's hope not. I started in your Department of First Stories, but I started a novel at the same time. You were the first place I was published, but at the same time I was working on my first novel because I had been a professional writer and I'd been a freelance writer, and one day, in a fit of madness, I gave all my clients, my paying clients, 30 days notice, and 30 days after that I was writing fiction full-time and have been doing that ever since. So when your acceptance came, it was just one of the greatest days of my life. And actually, if I may say something about your sister magazine, my second published short story was for Alfred Hitchcock's Mysterious Photograph.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And what is it, 250 words?
Yes, it is 250 words. Yeah.
So when people talk about writing flash fiction these days, I think, well, I did that for Alfred Hitchcock.
So you can do any length, literally.
I like to think that's true. Yes.
Well, actually, I don't feel that I belong in this august company because I am not an accomplished short story writer, and I came to that kind of writing very late. I had written a great many novels before it ever came my way to be invited to do a short story for an anthology. And although now I find it easier to say no, at that point in my life, if anyone asked me to write anything, dog food recipes, whatever, I would try. And I find I have great respect for people who write short stories because they are able to take a little moment in time and bring it to life to the readers. And I think my problem is that I can't ever tell a story without going into enormous detail. And my husband will say when I'm trying to describe what happened during my day, well, yes, but yes, what happened? Get to the point. So I love short stories. I think they're wonderful. I wish I were better at it.
But actually, Carolyn, I have to say that in just, 7,000 words, maybe less, with the story you podcast for us, you've recreated a whole era. So you are able to do something in it. It's quite
Listen.
Significant in a short space.
7,000 words is a tenth of a novel for me.
Oh, okay.
She's on to me.
Yes.
It's like poetry. I think if a poem goes much past one page, maybe it's a short story.
Yeah.
If a short story goes much past 2,500 words, maybe it's a book.
Well, yeah. And actually, the character in this particular short story went on to be the central character in a novel.
In Letters.
A Letter from Home.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, oh, I remember and that short story. I loved that short story.
Thank you.
I was really happy when that became a novel.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I enjoyed writing it. You know, it.
See, you can enjoy writing.
Well, it's occasionally.
But you're already thinking as you're writing it of the book. Were you thinking of what?
Yes, yeah. I was. I was thinking about a book.
I
you know.
See.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's where the first Deborah Knott came from. It was a short story, and Sarah Paretsky mm-hmm. did a Woman's Eye anthology, and asked me to do a short story, I created Deborah Knott. I'd been thinking about doing this character, but that was the first time that I had actually tried out that first person mm-hmm. smart mouth persona. Mm-hmm. And I'll always be grateful to Sarah for doing
yes.
that anthology and inviting me to be in it, because I mean, I'm sure Deborah would have come anyhow, but that short story gave me a chance to
crystallize
try
it.
The voice mm-hmm. just as you did
mm-hmm. exactly mm-hmm.
I had just the opposite experience in the fact that a short story has never given birth to a novel for me, but
You've
doing
gone.
A short story for you, Janet, and Ellery Queen let me continue my trilogy of Marie Lightfoot after I wasn't
finished
going to do the
yeah.
series anymore. And so I got to do a long short story to spend a little more time with Marie, and I really loved being able to do that.
Do you think you'll do anything else with Marie?
I don't, unless it would be a short story. She was always going to be three books,
mm-hmm.
And so I don't think I will. Right. I was just going to say another advantage to me of working on short stories, well, a two-part advantage. One is you can finish them.
That's nice.
And the other is you can, I think, for me at least, get closer to having it turn out the way you originally envisioned it to be, or having it be as good as you wanted it to be, where with a novel, there are always parts that if I were smarter or better or had more time or whatever it is, I would go back in and rework some more. But I've written a few short stories that I think I wouldn't change.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have that feeling with my novels. You all may have different experiences in that regard. But
no, you always want to smooth the cowlick and tuck
yeah.
in the shirt.
Oh, every time you go back over a book, you know, when I get a copy edited, or not copy edited, copy edited manuscript back. No, not copy edited, line edited, pardon me. I love that period of time because I'm going to go over every word, every sentence, every paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And I will hear writers say, oh, well, they only had a few little things. And I'm thinking, well, why weren't you going over?
Yeah,
you know,
oh, right.
This is
yeah.
your
last chance
yeah.
before
this
the
is your last
yeah.
chance.
That's
yeah.
right.
You know.
Right. And I recently, I shouldn't tell this probably, I recently discovered there was one more chance than I knew, which was to go over the second pass galleys of a book rather than just the first pass galleys.
To make sure they made the corrections
yes,
that you
exactly.
want. Yes,
oh, yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I know. Yeah. After all these years, I just found that out.
You mean they didn't make the changes that you had asked for?
Sometimes an error could occur.
That's right. Sometimes an error can occur. And
I've never had that happen.
Well, I had a major change, law change, in galleys this time. Mm-hmm. And so I really, and my publisher is wonderful. Copy chief, and I knew she'd do her best to get it in, but I was paranoid and wanted to make sure because it was so important to
yes.
the book.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one or two small things had not gotten in, although the big one had. So mm-hmm. I'm always going to, from now on, ask to see second pass. I think to make
well,
sure.
Thank
my
you, darling.
In.
I'm going
to
start
you're
asking
too.
No, this is terrible. Copy chiefs, if any copy chief hears this, they've gone white.
Well, Nancy, you had mentioned to me once, I think, that you feel that the tone of your short stories may be very different from what you write at novel length.
Well, that's what my book editor says. She thinks my short stories are much cooler, chillier than my novel tone. And I think some of them are. I think there are some others I've written that she may not have read that have a warmer tone to them. But if I'm going to write a colder tone, I'm going to do it in short stories rather than in novels. Because, again, it comes down to what do I want to spend that much time
yes.
on? And I want to spend more time on something with more warmth
right.
than
mm-hmm.
I do with something
I
that's
cold.
I
keep thinking of Blue Moon. That was a cool
one. That was a cool one. It was definitely.
It really was a cool
yeah,
short story.
It was.
And where was that published, Nancy?
Was it your... I think it was your Valentine's Day
was
anthology,
was it the
Caroline?
Valentine anthology?
Caroline.
Oh, I think it was. Uh-huh. I think it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you find anything... Has anybody commented to you that your stories are different in mood or tone from...
No, not really. I get that with the difference between the Sigrid Harrell books and the Deborah Knott books.
Uh-huh.
People tell me they don't seem as if they were written by the same person.
Yes.
Because I do mm-hmm. deliberately cramp my spirit when I'm writing Sigrid Harrell. And again, I have to thank her for letting me have another bite of the apple mm-hmm. and do another Sigrid Harrell story.
And you mean Janet?
Yes.
Let you do.
I'm
yes.
sorry.
Yes.
We do.
Yes.
We had a, two stories, I think, since you stopped doing the novels.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm really getting a sense here that Ellery Queen's magazine is rather important to us. It's played really pivotal roles in all of our
when
careers.
When I first started writing short mystery stories, Ellery Queen was the pinnacle.
Oh, definitely.
I really,
definitely.
And people would say, you know, well, where should I send my this, that, or the other? And I always said, start at the top and work down. Mm-hmm. So I always started with Ellery Queen. And I always got the rejection slip back within two or three weeks. And my first short story was published in Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. Which Eleanor was still editing then, though, right?
Janet was
to
make sure it's not that she was not editing.
No. Well, but I thought that maybe Eleanor was Eleanor at one point edited both magazines.
No,
so
Kathleen was
there.
No, it was when Ernie Hutter went before.
Oh, before the company owned both magazines.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. Ah. Hitchcock was a separate.
I see.
Entity, yeah. And I had sold several stories to Ernie Hutter, who was the editor down there in Florida. And I just thought Ellery Queen was the top, and then Alfred Hitchcock was next. And then it just sort of, you know, then you had Mike Shane, and you had The Executioner, and you had a lot of magazines that I put out of business.
They're not there anymore.
They're not there anymore. And I was in the last issue.
Oh, you were?
So you... I better not say this or you won't buy anymore.
I think it would have happened by now, Margaret, if I was going to, with your stories.
Which
story is
going to
be the one? Well, you're bringing up the different mood between the Sigrid stories and the Deborah Knott books brings me to another topic I wanted to ask you all, because you've all written mysteries at novel length, at least about set in small towns. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you why you chose small towns. I mean, I know that the reason in some cases is that you're from small towns, but do you like writing mysteries in that type of setting, and how does it differ from choosing a city setting?
Well, I have done both, because some of the Henryo books are not in, they're on San Antonio mm-hmm. and fairly places like that. But with the Death on Demand series, I wanted to set it on a sea island, so by you know, that by definition is going to be a small community. Yeah. And I do like writing about a small community because people know more people. And the thing about the traditional mystery is that we're dealing with people who have relationships with many others around them. And it's when those relationships become twisted and soured that we have the basis for a mystery. And I think that we can focus. But, you know, anybody, well, let me put it this way. When I wrote the book about the little town in Oklahoma that was set during World War II, Letter from Home, I grew up in Oklahoma City, and it was not a big town during the war years, but it was, 100,000, 200,000, something like that. And when Tony Hillerman, bless his dear, generous, kind heart, gave me a quote for Letter from Home, which is set in a very small northeastern Oklahoma town, and we were speaking on the phone, and Tony said, "What little town did you grow up in?" And I felt like someone had just handed me the moon. You see, Tony grew up in Sacred Heart, Oklahoma.
Oh.
So he really knew small towns in Oklahoma. So I don't know. What, Margaret?
You find small towns anywhere. I love to visit my agent up on the Upper West Side. We walk out onto the street. We walk down Broadway. She runs into her classmates' parents. She runs into old classmates, people she's known for years. My editor used to live down near the Village, and that was a whole different neighborhood, too. It was like a small town. Her husband knew every store owner, every hardware shop, every place she got the keys made, every deli. And it was like a small town. Now, take him above 14th Street, and he was lost. And I don't think Vicki would be that comfortable below 45th, maybe. But, so even New York City can be a small town if you've lived there long enough. Mm-hmm. And I do like writing about relationships and how the community impacts on each other. So, but it doesn't have to be a rural small town. It could be New York City.
It's so funny, Margaret, because I tell virtually an identical story about my agent on the Upper West Side. Mm-hmm. About them, and that I had an epiphany about small towns the day I walked out with her. And we went to the little bitty grocery store, and they asked about her mother, and she asked about their kids. And we went to the dry cleaner, and they knew her by name, and she knew them by name. And she just as you said. And I thought, this is her small town.
It is. Mm-hmm.
I grew up and I've lived all my life in the Kansas City area, and Kansas City's not a quote unquote small town. And yet, I spent my early lives in a family. I was an only child, and we went to a big Presbyterian church. It took up an entire block. It was big enough to be a small town. It had enough members in it that it was like a small town. We were there Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night for potluck dinner. We were there for choir practice. I was there for Sunday school. I will say that I left when I was 13 and never went back. You know, you leave your small town. But I loved it. It gave me such a sense of security and safety to have that small town in my big city. I love the idea of a compressed, well, really it goes back to the English Agatha Christie country manor. Mm-hmm. We make our small town is our country manor, and we have a certain number of people, and it's all kind of compressed, and emotions are compressed, and things can explode. Mm-hmm. And I think that can happen in any neighborhood in a city as well.
Oh, I do too. Mm-hmm. You know, violence and unhappiness and misery are everywhere. They're not just the back alleys. You know, they're in at the PTA just as well.
As is generosity.
Exactly,
and
kindness
heart,
and goodness.
The sort of thing that people associate with small towns without realizing they may be experiencing the same thing with their very kind next-door neighbors or whoever they may happen to be. Yeah.
You all have written series as well as non-series books. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of working on a series as opposed to a non-series book?
Well, actually, I remember when I wrote the first book in the Death on Demand series, and I hadn't sold any books in a long time, and I was so fortunate, and it sold. And the agent said, they want to know if it's a series. And I said, oh, of course. And I had no idea.
It's never occurred to me. So the market entered into that as well. Right.
Yes, and I think now I feel so comfortable in a series. Uh-huh. I enjoy revisiting these characters. I still enjoy Annie and Max after all these years. They will always be young and happy on their sea island. And it's a pleasure to me to join them there. I love my new series with the redheaded ghost who comes back to a little town in Oklahoma. And I have probably bid farewell to Henry O. in the Henry O. series.
And why is that? Oh.
Because they want 2 books a year, and they want one Death on Demand and one ghost, and I can't manage any more than that.
You would be the ghost.
I would be the ghost, right. Yeah.
But
the series are so much fun. You know, they give you this sense, it's that community, you know, mm-hmm. and it exists in your mind, just like Margaret with Colleton County.
Yeah, I do feel like it's out there somewhere.
Exactly.
And every time I get to go visit it. But to address your problem, we can do this in short stories, do the different mm-hmm. voices mm-hmm. and do the different places. And as Nancy was saying, you can explore little facets of life that you couldn't necessarily in a novel. Certain things had happened to me. For instance, when I was a child, I remember very distinctly walking out one moonlit night when you could do this in the country and not worry about anything happening to you. And it was a beautiful moonlit night, and I walked down to the edge of the woods, and beyond that was the cornfield, and we heard corn. I heard corn growing.
Uh-huh.
You could hear the squeak and the pop
the
plant, because it had rained, and then the sun had shone on it, and it was 6 inches taller the next day. And so you can hear it growing.
And that is one of the most beautiful passages in Bootlegger's Daughter.
Well, thank you.
It is.
But I carried that image in my mind all the time that I was writing the New York books. There's not any corn growing.
Yes,
in
right.
I'm sorry. So I didn't know what I was ever going to do with it. But then when I did start writing the Deborah Knott books set in the country, there it was. And I could use it. And so I really do enjoy coming back to the series, but I do also occasionally like to write something standalone. So far I've only written 2 standalone novels, but all of the short stories have pretty much
been standalone. That's mm-hmm. yeah, except for the cigarette stories,
yeah.
Right.
Am I the only one who's actually worked on 3 series here?
No, because I have 3.
You have, yeah. You have 3 too. Mm-hmm. Well, my 3rd one was the 3 books I did for the Virginia Rich Estate, and I loved working on series when I worked on them, but there came a point at which I really wanted to do third-person, multiple point of view, and my series were first-person. My Jenny Kane series was first-person. Marie Lightfoot was, well, a mixture of things, but I wanted to do strictly third person,
but Nancy, you did that. You were the first one that showed me that you could mix.
Oh well,
first
I cheated. That's true. I cheated. But Jenny was essentially Margaret's talking about when I did Marriage's Murder for the first time. I had a situation in which mm-hmm. I really wanted the reader to be on the scene of the crime, and I couldn't get my first person heroine on that scene. So that's where the first chapter came, and that's when I did that for the first time, I believe. And it was kind of considered cheating in those days. But I thought if you do something while I'm writing, you can get by with anything.
Exactly. And you didn't mm-hmm. even necessarily start separate chapters. That's how I keep it differentiated now that I'm using third person and mixing first and third.
Uh-huh.
I will start a separate chapter so that I never lose the reader. But you did it so seamlessly in a couple of those Jenny books.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, thank you.
That
oh,
even though you went, you had first person part of the chapter, and then you had the big page break, mm-hmm. and then you got into the third person viewpoint, and you did it so seamlessly that I was halfway through the book and I thought, hey, wait a minute. She's cheating. Oh, I wonder if I could do that.
Well, you know, the honest truth, and I'm just realizing it now as I'm sitting here, is I've actually tried first person when I've, in the 2 standalones I've done in the last few years, I've tried it when I've run into a problem. And I've written half of a book, sometimes rewritten it in first person, trying to see if I could make it work. And it didn't work. It's as if I can't write first person anymore. What it has done for me has been to give me greater insight into whatever character I'm writing in third person.
Exactly.
But I seem to have lost the knack to writing first person.
Oh, I doubt that.
I don't know if
it's riding a bicycle. You mm-hmm. won't get it.
Well, maybe. But I'm really happy doing third person. So,
well, I like third person. I do third person in the Death on Demand books because I can obviously move from viewpoint to viewpoint. But I very deliberately made my ghost book first person, and I do have to believe that it's the only, I mean, the paranormal has exploded, and honestly, I wrote that book before that all started, and they sat on it for about 2 years. but what distinguishes the book, I think, makes it a little unusual, is that the ghost is the protagonist, and everything is seen from her perspective in first person. But what that does in that book is it's the omniscient viewpoint. Because, of course, she can disappear, and she observes people, and the only stricture is that whenever she's observing characters interacting and overhearing them, there has to be a real reason why she chose to be at that moment where she is.
I also think it's really important that Bailey be in first person, because there's a certain sweetness to her point of view that I don't think anybody else can give, and that's such an important tone of those books.
Well, thank you, Nancy. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Now, Nancy, I wanted to start with you with this question, because I think when you did make that shift to non-series books, some reviewers said this is really a shift for you to more mainstream sort of books. So what do you feel the difference is between writing books that fit snugly into the mystery category and those that might be considered more mainstream?
Somebody recently described this for me in a way that made sense to me that I didn't understand. I am and always will be a mystery writer. That's where my heart is, that's where my head is, that's who I am. However, there came a point at which I wanted to do, as this person said, not even talking about me, I don't think, wanted to set a mystery in a larger tapestry of life. And for me, that meant more viewpoints, something that I call, for my own use, a 360 view of an event. And I wanted to be able to go into all these heads around this event in order to show the impact on this. And I wanted to be able to see not just the events of detecting a crime. I wanted to know what happened before the crime, and I wanted to be there. I didn't want one character telling another. I wanted to be there. I wanted to be on the scene of the crime, and I wanted to follow people after the crime. That's a bigger book than I have been writing before. So if that makes it mainstream, then I guess I'm heading more toward mainstream territory. But what I feel as if I'm doing, I mean, and that would be fine. Mm-hmm. I'd be more than happy to have mainstream readers. But I just think it's real important for me as a writer to remember, you know, the old saying, dance with the one who brung me.
Right.
You know, mysteries brung me. So yeah. I'm going to keep dancing with mysteries at the good. Heart of whatever
I'm glad to hear that. Margaret, your books are taught in courses of Southern literature, and you've also won literary awards. Do you make any distinction between the work that you do that is...
No, I'm like Nancy. I'm perfectly happy to be called a mystery writer. I really don't try to categorize my work or make definitive statements of it. I feel that that's the, you know, I write the books, I send them out. Whoever wants to take them can. They can say whatever they want to say about it.
Right.
I really don't care at this point. I really don't. I mean, I like a good review better than a bad review.
Sure, yes.
But as far as saying you're literary or you're not literary or you're trash or second rate, I don't care. That's nothing to do with me. I do the work. I do the best work I can. I put it out there, and then we see what happens.
Right.
You know, I really do think that's really true. I often think it's none of my business what somebody thinks of my work. You know, that's their business.
It's
exactly.
A subjective thing.
It's their response is theirs.
That's right. Yes. And I'm like you. I'd much rather have a good review than a bad review. And if they want to go into hyperbole and talk about that, that's just
fine. Yeah, and find symbolism.
Absolutely. Yep.
The first time.
Be my guest.
The first time one of my works got picked up for a textbook. And it was a short story. And I'm reading the questions at the end of the short story. And they're saying, notice how the author did so-and-so. And did you catch the symbolism? And I'm going, really? My goodness.
We do a lot at the unconscious level that other people have to bring to our consciousness.
I know. And when somebody does a paper on you, and it just blows my mind. I mean, that somebody's going to sit down and analyze my work.
Well, there are all sorts of scholars now of the mystery, and I'm sure they're studying your work and writing papers and dissertations. And
because I do issues that face the South.
Yeah.
I mean, I do try to not every book, and I certainly try not to preach, but I do want my readers to think about some of the problems that we're facing here at the beginning of the 21st century. And I really hate it when I feel like that we are selling our birthright for a mess of pottage, to quote Genesis. I mean, as Nancy will tell you, half of my influence comes from Sophocles and the Bible.
Oh, okay.
That's right. We were doing a panel together once at, where was that?
I don't remember. We've been on a few panels.
And somebody said, you know, where do you get your ideas? And I said, from the Bible and Sophocles. And, yeah. And someone else said that she got hers from Mother Goose. We had a lot of fun with that panel.
Well, I always love the question of where do writers get their ideas. And, you know, some writers get really kind of snippy when they're asked that. And the truth of the matter is that almost everything in every book that a writer writes comes from some source. And I the story I'd like to tell is, let me see which book is it. I think it was in Dare to Die, which came out a couple of years ago. A young man is talking to Annie, and he's describing the girl that he knew when they were both in second grade. And he looks at Annie, and he says, we were yellow birds. And she said, well, what was that? And he said, well, you know, the good readers were the bluebirds, and the okay readers were the redbirds, and then there were the yellowbirds. And Iris and I were always the yellowbirds. And there's more to that story, but the basic part of that story came from the fact that when my husband was in the second grade, the teacher divided the class into the bluebirds, the redbirds, and the yellowbirds. Mm-hmm. And my husband was a bluebird, but he never forgot the yellowbirds. Oh. And told me that story many years later. And then it ends up being a scene in a book more than 50 years later. No, 60. I mean, I won't count.
That's wonderful.
A good many years ago.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes we're like birds building a nest. You know, you take a string from here and a feather from over there, and by the time you finish, you've got your nest. Uh-huh. But to say that I'm going out and get just strings, or I'm going out and just get feathers, no.
And sometimes you just take somebody else's feather and somebody else's string. Exactly. Carolyn took her husband's feather for the
story. Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, Mary Roberts Rinehart compared writers to crows, and she said that crows pick up bright objects and take them and hide them. And then when they want them, they go and get them. And that's what writers do. We collect odd and unusual and different things, but someday we'll use them.
The older I get and the longer I write, the more I'm aware of the fact that when I start a book, I can't do it unless it's some idea that has haunted me or won't let go of me. And you know, always people will say, well, do you worry that somebody's going to steal your ideas? And never. For one thing, if they use it, it'll become their idea and they'll put their own slant on it. But the other thing, and I also never worry about forgetting an idea. If I forget an idea, then it wasn't a strong enough idea to hold my attention. The ideas that go into my books are ones that may have been tugging at me for a very long time. And finally you have to work them out. If you can't work them out in life, then you can work them out in your fiction.
Right.
It's funny about, you were talking about the ideas, like you have really a rather important idea about your Judge Deborah stories, in which you want people to be aware of what they're so blithely giving away in the terms of the beauty of North Carolina and other things about the heritage. My version of that is in Kansas. I live in a state, as does Carolyn to some degree, that is viewed as a stereotype by a lot of people abroad in the world. A flyover state. To me, my state, as Carolyn says to her, is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I know these people intimately as real, whole people. And there's plenty of criticism abroad about Kansas, much of it richly deserved. But I'm happy to let other people write all that. What I want to write about is, and what's new and fresh, as far as I'm concerned, what surprises people is not the negatives, it's the positives.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I want to write about, I think, you know, we could all write, I could write about whatever is going on politically in Kansas at the moment, and there's always controversy of some sort. That's going to change 5 years from now, and it's going to change in another 5 years, but there's certain underlying values, and values is the wrong word, but a certain underlying humanity in for both good and ill that doesn't change so much, and that is common, I think, to people all over. It's a truism, but we forget it when we stereotype an entire state. So, you know, somebody wise recently said that the minute you judge someone, you stop understanding them. So what I want to write about when I'm writing about my state of Kansas is that moment, but it's the place where you don't judge, you understand. And that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with anything contemporary. So I sort of aim for a tone that is kind of timeless, I hope, that isn't rooted in whatever's going on at the moment politically.
Oh, I feel that very strongly.
And I think that we share that, the three of us.
Dora Welty was famous for saying, let your stories grow out of the ground beneath your feet.
Oh, exactly.
Yes, that's
and that's
wonderful.
Exactly what
that's
we're trying
right.
to do, I think.
Yeah, I can see it so much in both of your work.
Well, that's why I'm so happy to be writing a series set in Oklahoma. It's been such a pleasure, you know.
Well, when she was writing the Jenny Kane books, the Jenny Kane books were perfectly fine books set in New England.
They were
delightful. But the book that I loved the most was Bum Steer.
And
when she took
did.
Her Kansas and got her hands dirty.
That's right.
And it was so real.
Yeah. I don't know why it took me so long to... Even the Fort Lauderdale version that I wrote in Florida was more real to me because I knew it. In a way that I had never known New England, knew it and loved it.
And why did you choose New England originally for that?
Because some pretty mundane reasons when I was first starting out. At that time, regional mysteries were not popular and were not being bought. Virginia Rich was about the only one who had the nerve to set a mystery in a small Midwestern state, in a state, in a small town in the Midwest. And I thought, okay, I could write a novel, my first novel about... somebody in a small town in Kansas, and it's going to land on a New York editor's desk and it's going to go nowhere. Or I could set it in New England, which I've always loved and where I would live if I could. At least at that time I felt that way. And it would have a much better chance of selling.
Well, actually, that was the precise reason I chose South Carolina. And the reason why is that I wanted to use a vacation background for the mystery bookstore. And the only vacation background I knew well was Hilton Head, South Carolina, because we started going there in the 70s. And we've been going, you know, gosh, 40 years now. Mm-hmm. I love South Carolina. They are so nice to me. They treat me like a South Carolina writer, and I am so appreciative. They're the kindest, nicest people. But what I really love about South Carolina is I love those alligators, those snouts up on
yes.
the bays, and the Spanish moss. Now, can't you just see anything happening when there's Spanish moss?
Absolutely, yes.
And alligators.
And less alligator in Oklahoma. It's been
Well, actually, we do have them occasionally. It's so sad.
Do.
Well, people have them as pets, and then they let them go. And, of course, the winter is usually too severe. They just caught an alligator the other day in one of our lakes.
Thing.
But we don't have them everywhere, and they're not 12 feet long and so ominous. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're amazing creatures. Mm-hmm. And they're everywhere, you know, in South
they
Carolina.
They really do look like something out of prehistory.
Oh, they yes. do. They do. They're so powerful looking.
And they're fast.
Oh, very fast.
30 miles an hour, apparently.
Oh,
uh-huh. For only a short distance, though.
Yeah, but they got you.
They got you. That's right.
All you have to do is run
31
miles an hour. That's right.
Don't trip. Well, they always have the woman.
Do not fall down.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. This morning, Carolyn, you were saying something very interesting about, I probably won't get this quite right, about the greater scope that the traditional mystery allowed you over the suspense story or novel.
Yes. Well, my sense is that with the suspense novel, certainly you can have wonderful characterizations, but the emphasis is always upon pace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they build to the very fast, intense sense of excitement. And in the traditional mystery, what I really like the best is the fact that you get to know these people and you have a sense of them as real human beings and people who are struggling with temptation, with desire, with despair. Agatha Christie once said that the mystery was, the modern mystery, that they were parables. And that's how I see the mystery, because we're telling stories about people who have succumbed to sin. And we are seeing a graphic representation in the book of what happens in lives when people do not do what they should do. Mm-hmm. So, to me, the traditional mystery, I never make any apology. I am proud to be a mystery mm-hmm. writer. I think mysteries are incredibly important socially, and they are intellectually challenging. But most of all, mysteries are an affirmation of goodness. Mm-hmm. No one ever picks up a mystery unless they want the world to be a good place. So that's why we write them, and that's why people read them. You know,
so. That's a wonderful summation of it,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Well, I've kept you all here awfully late, and so I guess we probably should close soon. Is there any other remarks?
Well, now we'll all lie in bed thinking about all the things
that we should say.
We can go on if you'd like. For sure.
We can rewrite it.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I've enjoyed it so much.
And
we kind of like each other.
I can tell that, and I think our listeners will see that too. So, well, good night then. Thank you.
It's been a long road, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Music for this podcast is taken from Abe Lyman and his orchestra's rendition of Weary Weasel, Brunswick Records, 1923. Sound editing and mixing for the podcast were done by Emily Giuliano. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.